meeting hers, darted all over the office. His blurry glance took in pale gray walls, rigorously ordered books and steel and glass shelves, a muted etching in a silver frame of the Countess Bathory in her bath. Nelson appreciated that Professor Victorinox looked at him as she fired him. But couldn't she just turn away just for a moment? I'm sorry. Nelson cleared his throat. Don't worry about me. Now, you may not think this is necessarily better than the first two versions, but I think you will agree that it's certainly more evocative and dramatic. It's full of visceral physical details and a lot of vivid imagery. To begin with, I fixed that clumsy opening sentence and made it clear that it was Nelson himself who was crossing the quad and not just his forefinger. I also added more visceral and ominous detail in the very first sentence by adding the clause about the clock ringing 13 under a windy, dramatic sky. The first paragraph is also improved by briefly foreshadowing what's going to happen to Nelson and by deleting that long description of the students milling about on the quad. Both the opening paragraph and the sentences that make it up are shorter, sharper, more detailed, and more focused. It's a more dramatic and more striking opening paragraph. Then, with the next few paragraphs, the narrative shifts slightly back in time in order to do three things. I introduce Nelson, I briefly explain his situation, and I introduce Professor Victorinox. Nelson's fear of the powerful woman across the desk from him is much clearer in this version because I evoke his fear with physical details. He clutches his knees. He swallows hard and tries not to cry. His glance darts all over the room. But even though Nelson is going to be the main character, it's Victorinox who dominates the scene. In fact, looking at it now, years after I finished the book, I'll confess that I rather gleefully troweled on the vampire detail. Victorinox is slender and thin-lipped and bloodless. She has silvery hair, sharp cheekbones, and a high forehead like a skull. I also gave her three adjectives, aristocratic, ancient, bored, that might have come straight out of an Anne Rice novel. Even the setting is designed to suggest vampire. She keeps her office blinds drawn during the day. She sits just out of the cone of icy blue light from her lamp. And again, as in the first paragraph, the sentences are shorter, sharper, and full of evocative and suggestive detail. The glare of her lamp, her rectilinear desk, the steel and glass shelves, the antique etching in a silver frame, even the subject of the etching, the legendary Countess Bathory, who reputedly drained young women of their blood, is another vampire reference. All of this, and some further detail that comes in the next few paragraphs, is intended to reinforce the professor's power and menace and suggest that she's going to be important later on. But it's all told from Nelson's point of view, which reinforces the fact that he's the main character of the book. We see Victorinox and her office from his point of view, and we participate only in his physical and emotional responses. He swallows hard and tries not to cry. He avoids meeting her gaze. He wishes she wouldn't look at him. He has to clear his throat before he's able to speak. Nelson may not get much of a physical description in these first paragraphs, but we get a vivid sense of him as a nervous person. And as soon as he leaves her office, I spend the rest of the chapter showing his accident and filling in his backstory in much more detail. As I was making these revisions, I was thinking about two things at once. I was thinking about both the book as a whole and the needs of the individual scene. And the way I dealt with every level of revision was by adding more detail. I served the larger narrative by introducing Nelson's point of view and by producing a more vivid introduction to Professor Victorinox. I served the chapter by starting with a brief description of the accident and then backtracking a bit to show what happened just before, implying that the rest of the chapter was going to show the accident in more detail. I served the scene itself by providing more action and dialogue to evoke the situation rather than just describing it. And I serve the prose by making the sentences clearer and more dynamic. However, adding more evocative detail doesn't necessarily mean adding more words. The published opening of the lecturer's tale that I've quoted to you is 377 words long, while that lamentable first draft was 406 words, and it wasn't nearly as memorable or detailed. I used more words in the first version to say less than I did in the final version with fewer words. So what did I learn or gain through these revisions? I learned that, in my work anyway, I often work from the general to the specific. My early drafts tend to be a kind of summary without much detail. My early drafts are often more expository than dramatic. Then, when I look at them again, I ask myself, what would a reader want from this passage that I'm not giving her? For example, what do the characters look like? Where is the scene taking place? What exactly happens in the scene? What do the characters say to each other, and how do they say it? In other words, when you're revising, you need to be your own toughest critic. You want to take all the techniques we've talked about in these lectures up until now, about evoking rather than describing, about using setting to evoke mood, about creating character through detail, about advancing the plot through dialogue, about letting a character's point of view guide the reader through a scene and so on, and apply them to your draft. However, I hasten to add that not every writer revises the way I do. James Joyce, for example, is said to have added nearly a third of the finished version of Ulysses in the galley proofs, or the sample pages that the printers had already set in type. If you've ever read Ulysses, or tried to, you realize that Joyce was not a writer interested in economy and concision. On the other hand, the American crime novelist James Ellroy developed an aggressively telegraphic style for his later books almost by accident. When his editor told him that he needed to cut 100 pages from the manuscript of his novel L.A. Confidential, Ellroy took an unusual approach. Most writers would have cut whole scenes and characters, but Ellroy kept all his scenes and characters, and instead he cut what he called the unnecessary words from each sentence. Not only did he significantly shorten the book, he in effect invented a new telegraphic prose style for himself. I've attempted this in my own work, trying to see how much I can cut out of a paragraph or a sentence without altering the meaning of it, though not as aggressively as James Ellroy. Sometimes, if I'm editing something on my laptop, I play a little game with myself. If a particular paragraph, for example, has 10 lines, I'll try to see if I can get it down to 8 lines. I don't necessarily recommend this technique to everybody. Some writers just aren't interested in lean prose. But if you're going for economy, or just trying to keep a passage from being boring, it's a useful exercise. You might even call it the Twitter technique of revision, since it's very similar to the effort it takes to make a wisecrack or a pithy epigram in less than 140 characters. And because I am old, and I can remember what life and writing were like before spell check and search and replace, I still usually do my revision and line editing by hand with a pen on paper. I do 99% of my composition on a keyboard, but I start each workday by printing out yesterday's work and marking up the text with a pen as I read through it. After that, I enter the changes on the computer file. If I'm pressed for time or feeling unusually contemporary, I might occasionally revise something directly on my laptop without printing it out. But there's still something about working with a pen and a printout that helps me think. Perhaps it's the last vestige of the muscle memory I gained from those 4 handwritten drafts of my first novel. I still have the callus on my middle finger of my right hand from having gripped the pen so tightly all those years ago. I guess I'm afraid that if it ever goes away, my career as a writer is over. Another technique I have found very helpful is to read each draft of a section or a chapter aloud. Many writers do this, and it's an excellent way to pay particular attention to your prose. For one thing, reading aloud is necessarily slower, so you're more likely to catch things like grammatical errors or repeated words. For another, it's a great way to gauge the rhythm and flow of the sentences and to figure out where the paragraph breaks should be. Please note that I'm not saying that the best prose is that which reads well out loud. There are some very great books, such as Mrs. Dalloway, which would be rather tricky to read out loud. But by reading aloud through the text at least once, by hearing the words spoken rather than just scanning them, you can catch a lot of things that might otherwise slip by you. As an exercise, take the exercise you did for the last lecture, where you tried writing a draft all at once or revising as you go, and reverse the process. For example, if you dashed out something without looking back, sit down with it again and try to figure out whatever you think is wrong with it by using some of the techniques in this lecture. You could read it aloud, for example. And if you rewrote as you went, you might take the same scene and try to add something new to it. Insert a new character, say, or change the setting, or even change the point of view or verb tense. Next time, I'll be talking about how fiction writers do research. And I'll be talking about Hilary Mantel and her research for her historical novels, Wolf Hall and Bring Up the Bodies, as well as the author Jim Crace, who has a unique approach to doing research for his books.
Lecture 23, Approaches to Researching Fiction.
I can't imagine a work of fiction that doesn't involve at least a little bit of research. Some narratives are obviously research-intensive. Historical novels, certain types of science fiction, thrillers that center around a profession such as the law or medicine or espionage. These and other types of genre fiction require that the author have some knowledge about a particular subject. Even the most mainstream middlebrow literary novel may often require a few hours of research so that the writer doesn't distract the reader with unnecessary errors of fact. Years ago, a friend of mine wrote a scene in which two people sat on a California beach on a summer evening and watched the constellation Orion rise over the ocean. Now, I'm no astronomer, but I did know enough to point out to my friend that A, most beaches in California face west, B, constellations always rise in the east, and C, Orion is visible in the evening only during the winter months. After being peeved at me for being a know-it-all, my friend changed the scene. Even though what was happening in the sky wasn't important to the story, it was easier for him to get it right than to risk annoying the rare reader who might have noticed the mistake. I've been on both ends of this particular continuum and several places in between. My first novel, The Wild Colonial Boy, was about the violent politics of Northern Ireland in the 1980s. I read a lot of books on Irish history, politics, and culture, and I spent a few very nervous days walking the streets of Belfast taking notes. I would never call myself an expert, but at the time I wrote the novel back in the late 1980s, I had acquired a basic understanding of Irish history and the British law on terrorism, as well as a rough grasp of the sort of slang an IRA bomber might use. At the other end of the spectrum, my novel Next takes place in the present day, and much of it is set in the city where I live, Austin, Texas. That doesn't mean I didn't do any research. It just means that the research was easier and less time-consuming than my research for The Wild Colonial Boy. For example, when I wanted to set a scene on a certain stretch of 6th Street in Austin, I just walked those few blocks and took notes about everything that might stand out for my character. And when I set a scene in a fictional coffee bar downtown, I spent a few hours one morning in a real coffee bar. I took note of the menu, the decor, the patrons, and the music the baristas played on the stereo. Many of these details ended up in the book. Even when I've written scenes that are pure fantasy, I found myself performing a little bit of due diligence. Part of the climactic sequence of my novel, Kings of Infinite Space, features ritual human sacrifice in a cave. Just roll with me on this one. And even though it's a patently ridiculous scene, I wanted the details of the cave to at least feel realistic. So I spent a few days visiting several publicly accessible caves in the Austin area. As you can see from these examples, the type and the amount of research you do for a work of fiction depends on the sort of story you're trying to tell. For example, say your story is about a police detective and a thoracic surgeon who fall in love. The point of the story is the love affair and not what they do for a living, so you might be able to get away with parroting a little bit of cop slang and some surgical jargon in order to establish your character's authenticity. On the other hand, say your story is about the detective investigating a murder or about the surgeon facing a particularly tricky procedure. In that case, You're going to need to learn enough about police work or surgery to make it look as though your characters know what they're doing. So, obviously, if your narrative depends on research, the more research you have to do. But even when research is important to your work, you still need to find the balance between factual accuracy on the one hand and the exercise of your imagination on the other. Without naming names, I can think of a number of novels I've read over the years which were more interesting for their research than they were as fiction. If the research overwhelms the story, then you're leaning too hard on the research and not enough on your imagination. In fact, the necessity of being completely faithful to the facts is not universally accepted among all writers. Some writers make their dedication to accuracy a point of pride and even a selling point for their work, while others are equally proud of their ability to invent a reality that may read as if it's factually accurate, but isn't necessarily. Two great contemporary writers who personify this divide are the English novelists Hilary Mantel and Jim Crace. Each of these wonderful writers have written novels that seem to require a fair amount of research, but they each take very different approaches to it. Hilary Mantel is best known for her historical novels about Thomas Cromwell, who was a Lord Chancellor of the Tudor King Henry VIII. The first two books, Wolf Hall and Bring Up the Bodies, each won the Man Booker Prize, Britain's most prestigious literary award. Mantel has often talked about how much research went into these two books, which was probably as much as would be required for an academic degree. In more than one interview, Mantel has stated that historical novelists actually have a moral responsibility to get the facts straight. She was especially vehement in a New Yorker profile, where she said, "I cannot describe to you what revulsion it inspires in me when people play around with the facts. If I was to distort something just to make it more convenient or dramatic, I would feel I'd failed as a writer." And here she is in another interview talking less prescriptively about how she enjoys crafting a compelling fictional version out of historical reality. "I have a general faith that true stories surpass invention in their twists and turns. I enjoy the research and being ingenious in what I do with it. I like to see what can be made from a little scrap of evidence without distorting it. I actually like the constraints, enjoy solving the narrative problems that arise when you have strict guidelines of fact. One problem is that real life does not have a neat dramatic shape, so you have to find it. There are techniques. You can't falsify the order of events, but you can control the order in which you report them and the emphasis you give them. You can't change the facts of an incident, but you can change its whole feel and meaning by the angle from which you report it." Now, compare this approach with that of Jim Crace, another celebrated and award-winning British author whose novels are often set in the distant past. His book, The Gift of Stones, is set in prehistoric Britain, when people were making the transition from stone tools to bronze ones, and his novel Quarantine is about Christ's 40 days in the wilderness, told from the point of view of some of the other residents of the Judean desert at the time. Crace, however, declines to call either of these books historical novels. He prefers to think of each of them as being set in a sort of alternate imaginary world that some of his readers have called Craceland. He does some research for these books, but a lot of the details he just makes up. In part, this is because he's not interested in the actual history as much as he is interested in using a particular historical period as a metaphor for contemporary concerns. For example, the impulse behind his novel The Gift of Stones was the industrial decline of the British city of Birmingham, where he lived for many years. Here's Crace talking about the book in an interview in the Paris Review. "I could have written a realist novel set in Birmingham about the collapse of the motor car industry, which is roughly the political impulse of the book. A realist writer would do that, but a non-realist writer, such as me, has to find a way to dislocate the subject rather than to locate the subject in a familiar world. I was searching for a parallel moment, and I found it at the end of the Stone Age. You can sneer at our terrible village accent and our ugly village center, but the world will always want stone bashers to make the cutters and the scrapers and the arrows and the axes they would have thought. How could anyone have imagined that something would come along that was sharper, harder, and lighter than stone? And then along comes bronze. And yet, if you read The Gift of Stones, as I did, without knowing that it was originally intended to be a metaphor for the decline of British manufacturing, it reads as a powerful account of an ancient, alien way of life. Whether it's historically accurate or not is more or less irrelevant to the literary merit of the book or to the truths the book speaks about human nature and the effects of technological change on everyday life. Rather than rely on exhaustive research to underpin his narratives, Crace instead pays especially close attention to his language. He makes very careful word choices to construct fictional details that seem utterly convincing, even if they aren't as scrupulously researched as the details in Hilary Mantel's books. In fact, later in the same Paris Review interview, Crace insists that if you pick the right words, you don't need to get the facts right. Here's how he puts it. My wife and my editor think I do lots of research, and I encourage them in their delusion as it makes me seem hardworking. But actually, I don't research. I oppose research. What I do is a bit of background reading in order to work out how to tell my lies. I don't look for information. I look for vocabulary and for the odd little emotional idea that will give some oxygen to my imagination. Vocabulary is the Trojan horse that smuggles the lie. Facts don't help. If you're not a persuasive talker at a party, no one's going to believe you, even if everything you say is true. But if you're a persuasive liar, then everyone is fooled. Crace then gives an example of how a simple bit of vocabulary can make a fictional world come alive by talking about a trip he took to the Judean desert before he started writing Quarantine, his book about Christ in the wilderness. Me and Izzat, my Bedouin guide, had been sleeping out in the desert under his jeep. It was the perfect morning. No one around, the bluest sky, and just baked landscape stretching away forever. Izzat asked, "How did you sleep?" He spoke impeccable English and Arabic. I said, "Me? I slept like a log." And as I said it, I saw his eyes narrow and I looked over his shoulder into the desert. Not a single log. All I could see, maybe a kilometer away, was an old tumbled thorn bush. I understood immediately that even though Izzat and I had language in common, this metaphor didn't travel. The metaphor couldn't cross the Mediterranean. Logs don't sleep in Judea. So I said to him, "How did you sleep?" He said, "I slept like a dead donkey. If you'd have kicked me, I wouldn't have woken." I borrowed that phrase for the book. What it told me was that plain facts weren't going to help me convince people that I knew about the Judean desert 2,000 years ago, but that vocabulary would do the trick. The trick of fiction was to remember to turn all my logs into donkeys. Now, Crace is being a little disingenuous here, of course. He says he opposes research, but he did book a trip to the same desert where Jesus reputedly spent his 40 days. And he did learn a vivid metaphor from his Bedouin guide that he never would have dreamed up on his own just sitting at his desk in Birmingham. But even so, while Hilary Mantel can talk about Tudor England as knowledgeably as a history professor, Jim Crace, by his own admission, has no expertise or even any special interest in the history of Judea in the time of Christ. And yet he's created a compelling and believable narrative set in something like that world. There's an obvious difference in intent here. Jim Crace isn't claiming that his novels are accurate. In fact, he's trying to subvert the idea of accuracy in fiction and insist on the primacy of storytelling. On the other hand, fidelity to what actually happened matters a great deal to Hilary Mantel. Still, I think Mantel is being a little bit disingenuous, too. A writer who was slavishly dedicated to absolute historical accuracy would have her Tudor characters speaking in some approximation of 16th century dialect, with lots of thees and thous and methinks. But in Wolf Hall and Bring Up the Bodies, Mantel very shrewdly has her characters speak in a modern-sounding idiom that makes them seem more real to a 21st century reader, but without making them sound anachronistic. The research she did for Wolf Hall is evident on nearly every page, but what makes the novel soar is the way her imagination inhabits the mind of Thomas Cromwell and the way her muscular and very modern prose evokes his world. Here's a passage from early in the book, when Cromwell is thinking about his role in London society as a sort of fixer for international clients. His house is full of people every day, people who want to be taken to Cardinal Wolsey. There are artists looking for a subject. There are solemn Dutch scholars with books under their arms and Lübeck merchants unwinding at length solemn Germanic jokes. There are musicians in transit tuning up strange instruments and noisy conclaves of agents for the Italian banks. There are alchemists offering recipes and astrologers offering favorable rates and lonely Polish fur traders who've wandered by to see if someone speaks their language. There are printers and gravers, translators and cipherers and poets, garden designers, cabalists and geometricians. Where are they tonight? Hush, his wife says. Listen to the house. At first there is no sound. Then the timbers creak, breathe. In the chimneys, nesting birds shuffle. A breeze blows from the river, faintly shivering the tops of the trees. They hear the sleeping breath of children imagined from other rooms. Come to bed, he says. This vivid catalog of business people and artists that begins this excerpt comes from Mantell's deep and intimate knowledge of the economic and social life of early modern Europe. But what makes this great fiction is the rhythm of the prose, the way it builds to the moment where Cromwell's thoughts shift seamlessly from his business to a moment of intimacy with his wife. No modern reader would mistake this world for the 21st century, but by the same token, no modern reader would mistake this prose for a 16th century text. The tension between Mantell's research and her imagination is heightened by the tension between the 16th century experience of Thomas Cromwell and Mantell's 21st century translation of it. Now compare this with an excerpt from Jim Crace's book Harvest. This exquisitely written novel is about what historians call the Tudor enclosures, when rural peasants in Britain were driven off the land so that powerful absentee landlords could raise sheep, because sheep were more profitable than rent from tenant farmers. Set in the same period of English history as Mantell's novels, Crace's book never mentions what year it is, nor does it include any reference to any real historical figures or situations the way Mantell's novels do. Instead, it's a detailed and intimate account of a remote, rural village that is being challenged by a new economic reality, as narrated by one of the villagers. Here are the first couple of paragraphs of the book's last chapter, as the narrator is leaving the village for the last time. So I have reached our village bounds. On this main lane, our outer limits are marked on one side by a mere stone, about waist high and vivid with its orange overcoat of lichen. It is dressed for traveling. I've not been this close to the edge for several years. It had always seemed too precarious a place. On our side of the stone, there can be no trespassing, as Master Kent has told us many times. If we stay within the bounds, there are no bounds to stay us. One further step beyond, however, and everything you have is left behind. I snap off a stalk of grass from our side of the limits, tasting our own fodder with an ox's mouth. I grasp the mere stone in both hands and bump my head against it, beating in the bounds, just as we have beaten the bounds into every village child as soon as they were big enough to stray. I am that boy who needs reminding where he does and does not fit. I bump the stone three times, just hard enough to break the skin and lay the groundings of a bruise, just hard enough to make me admit to pain. This has a contemporary immediacy, but as he promised in his interview, Crace evokes the feeling of a distant time and place mainly by using two bits of archaic vocabulary. One is mere stone, which is the old English word that simply means boundary stone. The other is the expression beating the bounds, another archaic bit of English culture. Beating the bounds is a ceremony marking the boundaries of a village or a parish by bumping the heads of village boys against a boundary stone to make sure they remember it. Neither mere stone nor beating the bounds is explained or put in any historical context. Given the antiquity of the two terms, this scene could have taken place any time from the 10th century to the 21st. But even if you don't know the history behind them, they evoke a different world from our own. These are real words from English history. I did say that Crace is a bit disingenuous about never doing research, but their use here represents the use of research at its most subtle and effective. Rather than overburdening the story with a lengthy and momentum-killing explanation of English folk tradition, Crace just tilts the camera, as it were, altering the reader's perception just enough to make the scene feel both vivid and strange. Now, my own belief about research falls somewhere between Jim Crace's and Hilary Mantel's. I don't have Crace's powers of linguistic invention, but I also don't have Hilary Mantel's ability to master a subject entirely before I write about it. To put it another way, I'm a bit more concerned than Crace seems to be about learning the history, but I'm less convinced than Hilary Mantel that the author has a moral responsibility to be absolutely faithful to the facts. There's another fine British novelist named James Hamilton Patterson, whose novel Gerontius is loosely based on the life of the composer Sir Edward Elgar. In the author's note at the beginning of the book, Hamilton Patterson talks briefly about his research, explaining how he deliberately changed some of the details of Elgar's life. And at the end of the note, he says, "For the rest, I tried to be as factually correct as was interesting." This has become my motto for doing research. This improvisatory, ad hoc attitude to using research seems the most sensible approach to me because it puts the story first. The primary purpose of a work of fiction is to create, in the words of John Gardner, a vivid and continuous dream in the mind of the reader. The two main requirements of any fictional narrative are to be both believable and interesting. So, as far as research goes, you want to use common sense. You want to get your facts right, because it will make the narrative both more interesting and believable. At the very least, you don't want to distract the reader with obvious, easily preventable mistakes, the way my friend did by having the constellation Orion rise in the wrong part of the sky at the wrong time of year. If your reader is stopping to think, "Hey, that's not right," then you've broken the surface tension of the dream. On the other hand, you don't want to be boring. Even Hilary Mantel has warned aspiring historical novelists not to inundate the reader with everything they've learned. "Don't show off," she says. "Your reader only needs to know about one-tenth of what you know. Depth of knowledge gives the writer confidence and suppleness, but doesn't need to be demonstrated on every page." Knowing when to back off from the research is also important to the process of writing itself. Years ago, I devoted several years of my life to an ambitious historical novel about an 18th century Dutch explorer named Jacob Roggeveen, who was the European discoverer of Easter Island. I eventually abandoned the novel for a variety of reasons, but one of those reasons is that I let my research overwhelm the narrative at the expense of the story and the characters. I accumulated enough books about the history and culture of the Netherlands and Polynesia to fill a 6-foot bookcase. I filled up notebook after notebook with all sorts of historical arcana. I spent 2 weeks in the Netherlands and another 3 weeks camping on Easter Island. I wrote draft after draft after draft, trying to work in as much of this detail as I could. The result was that after 3 or 4 years of work, I had only 200 pages of the novel, and I was nowhere near the end of it. Looking back on those pages now, I can see that they are impressively well-researched and that they have some vividly imagined scenes and characters. But for the most part, they have no forward momentum. In places, in fact, this unfinished book is monumentally dull because I lost sight of the character and the story, and instead I filled my pages with tons of dramatically useless detail about clothing and houses and ships and landscape. I wasn't writing a novel anymore. I was just mounting my research on the wall like a big game hunter. I hadn't yet learned Hilary Mantel's lesson not to show off, and I hadn't learned Jim Crace's trick of letting a word stand in for a world. But I did learn some valuable lessons from that experience, which I have applied productively to my subsequent books. The most important lesson I learned is that if you're writing a research-intensive narrative, the research and the writing should be inseparable. In practice, This means that you need to do the writing and the research at the same time. And this in turn means that to begin with, you'll be writing scenes without having any idea of what you're talking about. Yet this is the best way to do it, I think. With any research-intensive work of fiction, you don't know what you need to know until you actually start writing. I learned this the hard way. The dullest passages in my Dutch novel are the ones where I did all the research first and then went back and tried to create a story out of it. On the other hand, the passages that did work were drafted both before and during the research so that my imagination and the research played off each other. For example, one of the more successful passages was a scene in which Jacob Roggeveen travels from his home in the small Dutch city of Middelburg to the much larger and more cosmopolitan city of Amsterdam, where he was hoping to win the financial support for his South Pacific expedition from the Dutch West India Company. I knew from my reading that Jacob was a notary, which was a kind of lawyer, and that he had never married or had children, and that he was a member of a heretical Calvinist sect. But to begin with, I didn't know much about what Amsterdam was like at the time of Jacob's visit. And so my first draft was a bare-bones account of his trip and reactions, which I imagined were analogous to those of a small businessman from, say, Grand Rapids, Michigan, visiting Chicago in order to seek investors for some scheme. It was only after I had drafted a rough version of the scene that I realized I needed to know much more about what Jacob would have seen and heard in the streets of Amsterdam in the year 1719. I also needed to know how Jacob's fringe religious beliefs would affect his reaction to the vibrant street life of a big city. In part, I filled in these gaps by visiting modern-day Amsterdam myself. The old headquarters building of the Dutch West India Company still stands on a little square off a street called the Haarlemmerstraat, and I walked up and down the street the way Jacob might have, taking copious notes. When I came home, I read several cultural histories about Amsterdam, one of which gave a wonderfully detailed account of the Haarlemmerstraat. Back then, I learned, the street was near the docks, and it was mostly lined with taverns and brothels that catered to sailors who had just come back from long sea voyages, and that after dark, it could be a noisy, gaudy, and dangerous place. I also read more about the specific beliefs of Jacob's sect, and I learned that its members did not believe in the idea of sin in the traditional sense, but that what people called sinful behavior was just ignorance of their oneness with God, who controlled everything they did. But what really made the scene come alive in my imagination was the fact that one of the hotels I stayed in during my trip to Amsterdam was on the Rembrandtplein, one of the central squares of the city. What I didn't know when I booked the room was that the Rembrandtplein is lined with nightclubs that draw huge crowds of young people from around the world who party in the square every night until dawn. My room was up under the eaves of the old hotel on the third or fourth floor. It was summertime, and there was no air conditioning, so I was forced to leave the window open all night. As a result, I didn't get any sleep at all, but tossed and turned all night and listened to the thumping bass of Europop pouring out of the nightclubs and the shouts and laughter of the kids in the street below. In the end, I rewrote the scene about Jacob's visit to Amsterdam, bringing together all the things I had learned from my research and from my own visit to the city. Here's a paragraph from that scene. After a meal of bread and cheese and beer in the smoky kitchen of the inn, Jacob ascended to his hot, airless room up under the eaves. The little window in his room was high. He had to stand to see out of it. And he pushed it open and looked down the steep slope of the roof. Twilight filled the square below, punctuated by fans of lamplight falling out of tavern doorways. He took off his shoes and his waistcoat and tried to sleep on the sway-backed bed, but he only tossed and turned in the breathless heat, kept awake by the nightly riot below. Woven through the roar of the crowd were the whine of fiddles and the wheeze of hurdy-gurdies, playing songs Jacob remembered from childhood, rollicking dance tunes accompanied by the clatter of boots against cobbles as sailors and whores danced in the square. Sudden violent squalls rose above the general racket. The harsh voices of drunken men braying the words of the cuckoo's nest, the shattering screams of women dissolving into cackling laughter, bottles breaking, the wordless shouting of men in a fight, The loser's howl as a blade pierced him. More cackling laughter. And as the racket finally receded near dawn into a lone sailor singing tunelessly to himself as he staggered along, Jacob heard carnal groans coming from an entryway just below his window. It was all what his mother used to call wickedness, but Jacob, in his sweaty clothes and tangled sheets, struggled to convince himself that there was no such thing as sin, only ignorance and error, that the poor souls cutting each other in the street or rutting in the doorway were simply stuck in their own flesh like ships run aground in the mud. If I do say so myself, I think this works at least a little better than many of the passages in the novel, largely because I was able to model Jacob's restless night in Amsterdam after my own restless night in Amsterdam. Two lonely out-of-towners, centuries apart, trying to sleep while hundreds of other people were having noisy fun. My research into the city's history told me what sort of music the taverns would have played, and my reading about Jacob's religious beliefs told me that he would have been conflicted about what he heard. As for the rest, I just used my imagination to recreate what drunken sailors, tavern musicians, and prostitutes would likely have gotten up to on a typical night in the Haarlemmerstraat in 1719. All of these elements came together to help me create a scene that was reasonably accurate, dramatically satisfying, and consistent with my conception of the character. But the seed for it was the rough draft I wrote before I knew anything about the history of the Haarlemmerstraat or before I spent a sleepless night in Amsterdam. I needed to be writing even as I was doing the research. As a result, my research, my experience, and my imagination all sparked off each other in a dramatically productive way. The experience of writing this scene taught me that research is important, but you need to put the story and characters first. It was my research that showed me what a night in the Haarlemmerstraat would have been like, but it was my imagination that enabled me to filter that experience through the consciousness of a single character. Using your imagination is every bit as important as getting your facts straight. I'd even say that research is just another tool in the service of your imagination. It serves the same function in fiction that plotting and character and dialogue do. It helps to suggest, to evoke, to put the reader in a time or place she might otherwise never experience. Here's a very simple exercise that will help you think about doing research and using it in fiction. Pick a historical character who interests you, Abraham Lincoln, say, or Margaret Thatcher. Then write just a single scene about them doing something ordinary and private, like playing with their kids or making a sandwich, but at a time when something historic is going on that they might be thinking about. Abraham Lincoln might be thinking about the Emancipation Proclamation, for example, as he plays checkers with his son. Or Margaret Thatcher might be making herself a pot of tea late one night at the start of the Falklands War. Try to make it personal and intimate without letting the historical events dominate the scene. We're coming at last to the end of our journey together. So, in my next and final lecture, I'm going to talk a little bit more personally about what it's like to make a life as a writer.
Lecture 24, Making a Life as a Fiction Writer.
If you want to be a fiction writer, especially if you want to be a published fiction writer, you need to learn to be at least two different people. One of those people is the artist, the blinkered and driven obsessive who creates the work in the first place. By necessity, you must be solitary and self-critical, but you may also turn out to be moody, self-involved, and distracted. The other person that a writer needs to be, however, is the business person. And the business person's responsibility is to market and sell the work after it has been created. In this role, you need to be confident, good-humored, and gregarious. In other words, you need to be both the lonely genius in a garret and the glad-handing salesperson. You may drive yourself and everyone around you crazy while you create the work, but then you will have to charm other people who aren't actually related to you by blood, marriage, or friendship to read it and, who knows, maybe even pay for it. I'm not sure which of these personas is Jekyll and which is Hyde, but you need to learn to balance them with each other. As the great French novelist Gustave Flaubert put it, be steady and well-ordered in your life so that you can be fierce and original in your work. In this final lecture, I'm going to talk about these two halves of a writer's life. Please bear in mind that nearly all of what I'm about to tell you is only my own opinion, even more than the previous lectures have been. What I have to say is based mostly on what's happened to me or other writers I know, and on what I've observed over the years about the publishing business. Another writer might tell you something completely different on these same topics, and at different stages in my career, I'd have told you something different from what I'll be telling you today. This lecture is going to be part Jeremiad, part pep talk, and part sermonette. Let's start with the business end of it. Aspiring writers often want to know two things from published writers. One is, how do I get published? And the other is, how do I make a living as a fiction writer? If I had been giving this lecture 20 years ago, the first question would have been easier to answer than it is now, while the answer to the second question, how do I make a living as a fiction writer, has been the same for generations. You probably won't. In her famous 1929 book about women in writing, A Room of One's Own, Virginia Woolf said that in order for a woman to have the same freedom to write that a man has, she needs a room of her own in which to work and a guaranteed income of £500 a year, which would buy her the time to do nothing but write. Adjusted for inflation, £500 in 1929 is about £25,000 in 2012, or about $40,000. Virginia Woolf was lucky enough to have £500 a year as the result of a bequest from an aunt. But before that, she'd struggled to get by on the miserable sort of jobs available to women in the early 20th century, so she realized how lucky she was. Even today, most women writers, and most men for that matter, don't make that kind of money writing fiction. They have to earn their living doing something else and make the time to write as best they can. To put it bluntly, unless you're a very lucky fiction writer, you should keep your day job. Now let's turn to the subject of getting published. When I was starting out as a fiction writer back in the Pleistocene, by which I mean the 1980s, getting published was a difficult but fairly straightforward process. Back then, there were basically only two ways to get published. One way was to get the attention of an agent or a publisher. The other way was to pay a vanity press to publish your work. The less said about vanity presses, the better, but the more reputable route required that you persuade an editor at a literary magazine like Plowshares or at a genre magazine like the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction to buy one of your short stories. This in turn might lead to interest from an agent or a book publisher. Or you might find yourself an agent on your own who would market your book-length manuscript to commercial publishers in New York. The publisher would buy the book and pay you in advance against royalties, out of which your agent would take 10 or 15%. Then you'd go through the publication process of editing, copy editing, and printing, and between 8 months and a year later, the book would come out. The higher the advance a publisher pays you, the more effort they expend on your behalf. And so, depending on how much money the publisher paid for the book, you might be sent on a tour of bookstores, and a publicist might arrange interviews for you. If you were lucky, your book was widely reviewed in newspapers and magazines. If you were really lucky, you might have a bestseller, which means that the advance for your next book would be even larger. However, most published writers were lucky if they sold just enough copies to earn back their advance. This meant that publishers would at least take a look at their next book. Then, as now, and as it has ever been, there were a handful of writers who got rich off their books, and a slightly larger handful, mostly writers of genre fiction, who were able to live off their royalties without getting rich. The vast majority of published fiction writers don't make a living off their work. They consider themselves lucky to be in print, to make a little money on the side, and to be able to write fiction while holding down a day job. Now, at the time I'm giving this lecture, this is still the main way that many writers get published, and it's still the way that most writers, I think, would prefer to be published. Writers of all levels of experience love to rail against the imperious gatekeepers, namely the agents, editors, and reviewers of the mainstream publishing industry. But as in any unequal and dysfunctional relationship, we also crave their attention and want to be inside the club. More importantly, we like to be paid for what we do. But in the 30 years since I started work on my first published novel and started publishing articles and book reviews in newspapers and magazines, the publishing industry has gone through enormous changes. These changes are very similar to the changes that have happened and continue to happen in the film and music industries. This is a vast topic, too big for me to go into detail, but here are the main points. First, there are, at the time I'm giving this lecture, essentially only 5 large commercial publishers of English language fiction, and each one of these publishers is only one division of a much larger corporation. On the whole, these publishers are still run by people who love good books, but they are under tremendous pressure from the corporations they work for to meet profit projections. This business model means that publishers need to find and market blockbusters that will appeal to a large and diverse readership, or books that can be successfully marketed to a particular niche. The second type of book is often written by someone who is not necessarily a writer, but who is already famous for other reasons, such as an actor or a politician or an expert in a particular topic. Meanwhile, the majority of fiction writers, the sort known as mid-list writers, find ourselves earning smaller advances, getting less attention from editors than more profitable authors do, or just not getting published at all. Second, there are now a number of small, independent presses who are publishing the authors that the Big Five are no longer willing to publish or promote. On the one hand, these indie presses don't pay very much, and their books don't often get the attention from the mainstream media that books from the Big Five get. On the other hand, the editors at indie presses devote more attention to the books they do publish. They often treat their authors with a great deal of respect, and they are more likely to keep the books in print for a longer time. Third, and this is the biggest change, the one that has driven the two I've already mentioned, the rise of the Internet, the digital revolution, and the overwhelming success of online retailers, by which I mean Amazon, have irrevocably changed the way books are published, marketed, reviewed, purchased, and read. Some of these changes are frightening to those of us who came up under the old way of doing things. For example, every medium-sized newspaper in America used to publish book reviews, but now there are fewer newspapers than there used to be. And of the newspapers that still exist, only a handful of the largest papers, such as the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Los Angeles Times, publish book reviews at all. This means that the sort of books that would have received at least a few reviews under the old regime now don't get reviewed at all, and the shrinking number of books that do get reviewed get fewer reviews than they used to. And even these reviews have less authority than they once did. The influence of professional book reviews is now rivaled, if not actually surpassed, by reader reviews online. But the new order is not all bad news. As a result of these changes, the corporatization of commercial publishing, the rise of online bookselling and the e-book, and the consequent decline of brick-and-mortar bookstores, the power of the traditional gatekeepers has been greatly reduced. The answer to the question, how do I get published, used to involve laying siege to agents and editors and hoping you'd get noticed. If you couldn't get a commercial publisher to publish your book, you could get a vanity press to produce as many copies of your book as you were willing to pay for, but then no bookstore would carry it, and no professional reviewer would review it. Now, there are essentially no barriers to getting published. Anybody with a broadband connection can publish a manuscript online in a matter of minutes through any number of self-publishing platforms. For a little more money, you can even provide your readers with actual physical books through print-on-demand services. And today, self-publishing is much more widely accepted than vanity publishing used to be, even by authors who have previously published in the traditional manner. In certain genres, such as romance fiction, for example, a lot of writers simply leap past the gatekeepers of traditional publishing and sell their work directly to readers via the Internet, sometimes with considerable success. In principle, Self-published work is instantly available to the whole world. It used to be that if you read a review of a book that sounded interesting, you had to trek to a bookstore, assuming there was one nearby, and hope the store had a copy in stock. Now, you can download an ebook while you're still reading the review and be reading the book itself 90 seconds later. Another benefit of this democratization of fiction publishing is that the arbitrary barriers between genres have begun to break down. During my first week as a student at the Iowa Writers' Workshop in the fall of 1987, I was solemnly informed by two well-meaning second-year students that I should keep my love of genre fiction to myself. But when I went back to teach at Iowa in the winter of 2005, I was astounded and enormously pleased to discover that the students there, who were a generation younger than me, no longer cared much about genre distinctions. Two of my best students, in fact, were enthusiastic and unapologetic fans, as I am, of Joss Whedon's great television show, Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And you can see this change not just with the students I knew at Iowa, but as a general trend in literary life. For example, Colson Whitehead and Karen Russell are both considered literary writers, and yet Whitehead has published a terrific zombie apocalypse novel called Zone One, and Russell is the author of a creepy science fiction novella called Sleep Donation, about a plague of insomnia. And coming from the other direction, great genre writers such as Elmore Leonard, Denise Mina, George Pelicanos, Dennis Lehane, and Laura Lippman have garnered serious readers and mainstream respect for their consummate skill at storytelling, creating character, and crafting distinctive prose. I felt this welcome change in my own career as a writer. I have published entertaining but seriously intended works that feature sex, violence, ghosts, and zombies. As a reader, I find that I no longer get condescending looks when I say that both George Eliot's Middlemarch and Tolkien's Lord of the Rings are two of the greatest books ever written. To be sure, there are also downsides to this new, more democratic order. Certainly the traditional system of gatekeepers could be, and often still is, conservative or crassly commercial or elitist. And there are certainly many stories of agents and editors turning down books that went on to become bestsellers or to be considered masterpieces. But those gatekeepers also serve a useful function by wading through piles of dreck so that the reader and prospective book buyer don't have to. As a friend of mine once put it, the best thing about contemporary publishing is that anybody can publish a novel. On the other hand, the worst thing about the contemporary literary scene is that anybody can publish a novel. This fact is a particular drawback for writers. Even if you're one of the good ones, getting the attention of readers for your self-published work can be difficult at best. Getting into the traditional system is hard, but once you're in, you can at least count on your publisher to send out review copies and possibly even to arrange interviews with book bloggers and appearances at bookstores or with book clubs. Most readers understand that a traditionally published book has been selected by someone with a little discernment who read the manuscript and at least corrected the spelling and the grammar. Self-published writers do all their own editing, copy editing, proofreading, design, marketing, and publicity themselves, or they have to pay people out of their own pocket to perform these services with very little chance of ever making that money back. But this difficulty in getting the world's attention isn't really all that new. For the majority of fiction writers, the odds of success in the new system aren't really all that different from the odds of success in the traditional system. Even in the old system, many writers were and continue to be ignored. Most of the review attention goes to a handful of literary novels, and the vast majority of sales go to brand-name genre writers. The mid-list writer who publishes in the traditional way is not likely to get much more attention than someone who self-publishes an e-book. In both the old and the new orders, there are going to be a handful of very successful authors who sell a lot of copies, get a lot of attention, and make a lot of money. And then there are going to be a huge number of others who will sell a few copies to their friends and loved ones. In the middle, as always, are the rest of us, the mid-listers, who write the best books we can under the circumstances, and do something else to make a living, and somehow manage to find the time and energy to promote our own work through social media. Now, some writers will tell you that you should study the market, see what sells, and tailor your work to appeal to that market.